Right. Dear Rabbi Jay Kelman, dear friends, it's a real pleasure to be here, coming back to Toronto and meeting friends and presenting on a topic that I think it's very meaningful and important to discuss it. I'm very happy that Dr. Mark Greenberg is with us today and will also speak at the end, say his approach to this so difficult topic. And it's a special experience to meet people and discuss so important things in our life, like euthanasia. As Dr. Jay Kelman introduced before, I'm interested in teaching ethics, Jewish medical ethics, and I believe that there is a lot of contribution from the Jewish sources for the clinical context. I prepared a PowerPoint presentation, which I've discussed with students, and I hope you will enjoy it. I don't know if the lights are okay. Should it be turned off? Is it okay? The topic is euthanasia, end-of-life care. I'm trying to find answers for the clinical dilemmas in Jewish sources. And I feel that this combination of finding sources in old Jewish sources which relate to these problems is a special challenge. I would like to thank Dr. Warren Goldstein and others who helped to organize it, and Rabbi Kelman. And this combination shown in these shaking hands is actually what I want to show. The experience I had here in Canada with the hospital and the training in UFT, there's a wonderful program and Joint Center of Bioethics by Peter Singer and others on one hand, and the future, what I'm trying to do with Jewish sources, my experience in the yeshiva and teaching now in Ben Gurion University in the Negev, is a very special combination. I think that this combination, bringing two worlds together, which I could do here, is a special challenge which we need, that we need in Israel. This combination, bringing religious, secular people together, and find that we have wonderful sources. I would like to start with a short summary of Rambam. This year, there are now 800 years since he passed away, 1204. And he was actually the example of a person who combined so many interesting fields of expertise all in one person. This lecture is dedicated to Rabbi Dr. David Applebaum, who was killed last September. He was an outstanding scholar, Jewish scholar, and an outstanding physician and human being, and he was killed with his daughter on a tragic day just before his daughter a day before her wedding. I would like now to show, based on the Rambam, Maimonides, how these sources come together, and I think there are very special things we can learn for, like, an approach to Jewish medical ethics. He lived in a time, historically, in the 12th century, born in Cordova. At the age of a few years, they had to leave. The historical situation was that in Europe, the Christianity, there were the Crusaders, and in the Arabic world, the Islam, there was forced conversion. During his time, he escaped from Cordova to northern Africa, Fez, afterwards to, for a short time, to Israel, to Eretz Israel, Jerusalem, Alexandria, and where he lived afterwards was in Fostat, not far away from Alexandria. He was an outstanding Jewish scholar, who wrote a Perush on the Mishnah. He was a philosopher, one of the most outstanding works in Jewish philosophy, and he was a physician, all in one. And the way I want to summarize that all his outstanding contribution in Jewish literature, in science, medicine, astronomy, and philosophy, they are very, very unique. There is no scholar in the halakha like the Rambam. In Jewish philosophy, there's nobody like the Rambam, and for sure in medieval knowledge of medical practice, there was nobody like the Rambam, who was famous in his generation. A genius person, and I think that is the combination of Jewish medical ethics, three things which come together in one person which are really remarkable. At the age of 24 years, when he wrote his commentary to the Mishnah, Masechet Sota, he explains an expression, Ish Eshkolot, a very difficult expression in Hebrew. The Eshkolot sees, that's the way it is translated in the art scroll, they didn't find an explanation. Literally it means clusters, a title given to illustrious scholars, indicating their comprehensive Torah knowledge. That's the way they explain it. Rambam, at the age of 24, says, Eshkolot kinui al adam hakolel midot ma'alot v'chochmot lefi minehim v'hu ma shamru eshkolot ish shehakol bo. A person who knows knowledge, science, Torah, everything comes in all one person together. That is the expression of Eshkolot, Ish Shakolbo. And I feel when we talk about Rambam, but particularly on medical ethics, we have to bring all these components together to learn very clearly what is exactly the clinical problem, what are the Jewish sources, and what is our approach to apply them and to bring them together. Particularly in Israel, the challenge of bringing Jewish approaches, Jewish law, together with for these problems in ethics are a special challenge. Written in 25 years ago in the Encyclopedia of Bioethics is the following sentence: the State of Israel is an example of a newly emerging society that is attempting to harmonize traditional values embedded in ancient religious tradition with a contemporary outlook in confronting the concerns and dilemmas of bioethics. I think the special challenge to bring that together for Israeli law, bring these old sources really to life, and the interaction between finding the Jewish sources and letting them explain what do they mean for a modern problem. Not every rabbi can explain it to you because he doesn't know the clinical problem or he doesn't understand it, and not every clinician is aware of the richness of these Jewish sources because it's a very challenging profession and there are two different worlds. And bringing that together, I symbolize that with a special bridge to work on is a real pleasure and a challenge. The way I would like to present every topic, teaching it, and the way I would like to do it tonight is summarized in this list here. I would like to give a general introduction to the topic. What is the term euthanasia? A very confusing term used and mentioned in wrong context very often. I would like to look in the Bible if there are sources about it, later sources in the Talmud, classical rabbinic commentators from all the ages. There are a lot of sources for that, and the most important part would be for modern halakha, how it is decided today. It would be interesting to come to case discussions, which we can discuss at the end. How does that come together? That is the important part I would like to show. How do these sources really come together? So I would like to give a brief summary at a bird's eye view, sources of Jewish medical ethics and modern secular medical ethics. There's amazing advances in medical knowledge and possibilities to treat. End of life was previously the last days. There was not too much to offer. If a person is sick, there's a natural course, which is normally very short. There's not a situation that a person could be ventilated or total parenteral nutrition or many other possibilities to keep a person alive for a long time. That is a major change. There are legal implications. Every hospital has own ethics review boards, and not an important point is that different physicians, everybody has his own style, his own attitude. All these together are very important components for modern secular medical ethics. The Jewish sources, like in other world, we have biblical sources, Mishnah, Talmud, commentators afterwards, which are from the 5th century up to today, and the poskim, who try to decide for every practical issue what the approach is another world. What I try to do is to find different sources and to bring them together and to show the relevance. By doing that, I actually feel that is the very meaning of the term halakha. Halakha, the Jewish law, means it comes from Mount Sinai to us. That's the way it is explained by Rabbi Natan from Rome in his famous encyclopedia from the 12th, 13th century. Halakha, how does it come from the very beginning? How does it develop? How does it flow? And that's a very special feature of Jewish law, the oldest system, where we can bring very old sources to life in our daily practice. Another explanation Rav Natan from Rome gives is that halakha, it comes from the sources and comes to life. So it has really to be applied, and I think that's a very special challenge. I start now to talk about the first step of euthanasia. The term euthanasia means the action of inducing gentle and easy death. I found that in different encyclopedias, dictionaries. And here we have a difficult definition, because it is an action of inducing something. It's not the time when it happens, it is the time, it is the action that the physician or somebody else does it. That sounds like only active euthanasia. Is every kind of euthanasia active, or is there also a part that can be defined as not active, passive euthanasia? We will discuss that shortly. The etymology means oi, in Greek good, and thanatos, standing for death. It is a good, gentle, easy death. This term was created officially the first time in the 19th century by an Irish historian called William Edward Leckie. He has philosophical books and social studies, and he defined this term of euthanasia. I will show you in a moment that the term actually, in another context, appears in the Talmud 1,500 years earlier. Early philosophers are among the advocates of this measure to terminate actively the life of sufferers from incurable and painless diseases. People who are supporting it, they say that the quality of life, not to suffer, is more important than just the value, the absolute value of life. And there are famous philosophers who support it. In the Hippocratic Oath, it says, I will give no deadly medicine to anyone if asked, nor suggest any such counsel. So we see here that it's not clear, even if the famous oath of Hippocrates, it says very clearly, I will never do it, and that is certainly not accepted in medical ethics, in the tradition of medical ethics in many countries. To define the term euthanasia, we have to distinguish between passive versus active euthanasia. There are many situations where the person is ventilated. To pull the plug is not an action. You stop ventilating. But by pulling the plug, it is an action when you induce passive euthanasia. So there's a situation in between. There is a term which I'm very confused to understand, PAS, physician assisted suicide. I don't understand this term. I think there's a contradiction in the term, because suicide per definition means that a person kills himself. If he needs a physician to kill him, so it's not suicide, it is somebody else kills him. And this term, I think, has to be clarified. There are situations where they are called the double effect of narcotics, that you're actually treating, but it suppresses the respiratory function. It might suppress the respiratory function. There are orders like do not resuscitate. When a physician decides there is no hope anymore and we do not do any further heroic intervention to save him. We will not have the time to discuss the different legal approaches from different states, particularly Holland has a special approach for that, which are totally different than other countries. I think when we discuss the term euthanasia, it is important to remember what happened in the Holocaust with the term euthanasia. And these pictures, which are, we should never forget, talking about ethics and values in this profession. Here we see physicians who performed the hypothermia experiments. In the name of science, they actually learned how to kill. And we can learn very important lessons by looking briefly at the history of euthanasia in the Holocaust. I summarized that from the book of J. Lifton, the Psychology of Genocide. And he shows there that it started actually at the very beginning of euthanasia was by Dr. Karl Brandt, who was in charge of Aktion Brandt, killing chronically and terminally ill patients. He was the representative and the person was really in charge of the euthanasia program. But the way he started was that Hitler asked him personally, he was his personal physician, to kill a mentally retarded child according to the wish of his parents. And from this individual his story, he developed later on, and it is documented historically, he was empowered by Hitler with the so-called T4 project program, Tiergartenstrasse 4, it's in a code for the address, and they killed mentally retarded patients, children, they called it euthanasia. There was no or minimal resistance by physicians, and they were actually given more alcohol, vacations, salaries, and that was the way he could perform all these things. There was a bishop called Clemens Galin Münster from Münster, and he was against it and was very successful to speak out against that. The result was that Hitler really stopped it there, but he continued to send these physicians who learned euthanasia in Germany to send them to plan the final solution in Poland. So we see from reviewing the history that it started in very little details, in case by case situations. He developed it, and the slippery slope led at the end resulted in what we know about the mass killing in the Holocaust. Summarized in an outstanding paper by Leo Alexander in New England Journal of Medicine in 1949, he describes there he was the official physician for the interviews of the doctors in the Nuremberg trials. You see the picture here, that is Dr. Leo Alexander. And 2 years later, he published his paper in New England. He says there are very important clues, that the early changes in medical attitudes had all started from small beginnings and little things. It started with the acceptance of the attitude, basic in the euthanasia movement, that there is such a thing as life not worthy to be lived. And he gives examples from the resistance from Holland, saying that there was a little group who were very successful to resist so effectively the German medical profession. And they, if that would have been done in the early steps, the disaster of the Holocaust would not have happened. The famous sentence from him is, corrosion begins in microscopic proportions. I think that when we come to talk about euthanasia, we have to be very, very careful about these little things, which might be a little attitude, a little difference, and it's important to discuss it in much detail, because that's exactly the step to start preventing it. A common way to discuss topics and to analyze them in medical ethics are the four principles of the bioethics summarized here. There are reasons pro and contra, might be autonomy, could be on both sides. I think in each situation it has to be defined again and again. The reason to perform euthanasia is to die in dignity. There is no obligation to prolong and to suffer. On the other hand, never say never. It might be a wrong diagnosis. It might be an exception. There is no right to kill, and we have to be careful about slippery slope. And no doubt it can be a longer list. And I think it's very helpful to define before we approach any problem what's the reason pro and what's the reason contra. It doesn't mean that you have to decide, but it helps very much to analyze the situation. To analyze a situation of topics like that is extremely difficult. When we talk about the term suicide, it's very difficult to call what happened in Masada, for instance, suicide. Or another very powerful picture from the Holocaust, again, people who were running in the electric fence because they had no energy to survive and to fight more. I wouldn't call that suicide. Or an elderly sick person who has no energy to accept treatment. It's not suicide. So it's very, very difficult to define that. When we come to the Jewish sources, there will be no situation that we really have a clinical situation, a person is ventilated, turn it off, turn it on, the ventilation. We don't find it. It's the challenge of the rabbinic scholar to find these sources. That's what I'm going to present you now, to learn from different contexts and to understand what's the principle, what's the idea. Once we understand that, what are the values which are discussed there, it might be applied for a modern situation. And there is a lot of interpretation. There are a lot of different approaches. It's not easy to present a topic where we know exactly that there might be different approaches, and modern rabbis see it differently. I'm not going to give you any conclusion or psak. I would like to show how it works, how these sources coming from a terminally ill patient, from the context of discussion in the Talmud on suicide, or martyrism, captivity, when is a person allowed to stop his life, not being concerned to suicide, when does he have to continue as much as he can? And we see here, I think, an outstanding richness of tradition when we bring that together. I start now with the sources. Before, when we first thing we discussed euthanasia as defined in 1869, a term defining the process of dying and actively inducing the action of inducing. It's fascinating that 1500 years ago, before, the Talmud says the following sentence: a person in the context of Masechet Sanhedrin who has to be killed because he's a criminal, and he should be killed. The Talmud says only once in 70 years, a court is allowed to perform really the death punishment, capital punishment. But if you do it, it has to be done in the best way, in the most humane way. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rabba Bar Avuha, Amar Kra Ve'ahavta L'Recha Kamocha. It says in the Bible, you shall love your fellow as yourself. You shall choose for him a good death. Boror lo mita yafa. It's remarkable that translating the expression mita yafa, as pointed out by Chief Rabbi Lord Yakubovich from England, Zichrono Livracha, that is the first source talking about a good death. It's literally euthanasia. And he says the Talmud was aware there are certain situations where you have to help to make the death easier. Interesting, there's only one context where the Talmud applies that in this context. And I think that has to be mentioned just in brackets, that a good death learned from the Pasuk Ve'ahavta L'Recha Kamocha, it doesn't fit together. If you ask a child, what is Ve'ahavta L'Recha Kamocha? He will give you 100 examples. He will never ever say to help a person who has to be killed, a criminal, to die a good death. And I think we have here a very, very interesting insight of the Talmud. The love to the fellow man doesn't mean a person who you like anyway, or a person who you respect anyway. It's applied particularly for a person who you do not like, who you do not appreciate. You don't appreciate him at all. He has to be killed. To show in this context a human approach to him, the role of mitayafa, is a very special and deep understanding what is the real meaning of loving somebody else, not because you expect that he will return any favor to you, just because you respect any human being, even in that situation. The Talmud says that a person who has to be killed, that there were famous prominent women of Jerusalem, and they used to donate a special drink like a sedation, so these people wouldn't suffer too much when they go to their last way. It was a very interesting insight. Rav Yakubovich wants to learn from here that there is an obligation. The Talmud is aware of the obligation to make death easy and soft, the first description of euthanasia. The rationale of the prohibition is explained briefly in these psukim. There might be a much longer list. The first concept, of course, is that Lo Tirzach, from the Ten Commandments, you shall not murder. No active killing. There is a major difference of not treating anymore, where you feel there's no mission to help or to prolong suffering, and between passive and active euthanasia, where the physician really does something. The difference is not just between active and passive, it's another concept. Yakubovich and others bring these psukim that it's only the decision and the key which only God has it in his hands to decide about life and death. Ani amit v'achye. I kill and give life, and nobody else does it, so we shouldn't interfere with these decisions. A fascinating detail I would like to show you from Sefer Iyov, a person who suffered so much. It says there in the text that Iyov proclaimed, "Hen yikteleni lo ayachel, ach drachayel panav ochiach." He may well slay me, I may have no hope. Lo ayachel is written with lamet aleph, standing for no. But the text, it is the way the text is read, it says lo with the lamet vav, to him, and it makes a total different meaning. Of course, even if he kills me, even if he slay me, yet will I trust in him. That's the way it is read, and I think that is explained in the Talmud in Masechet Sotah. They didn't accept that a person says, I have no hope anymore. Even you want to kill me, God, I will still keep hoping. But that's not what it says. It says that Eov said, since you want to kill me, I have no hope anymore. So to understand the situation of a patient who is in his last steps, a terminally ill patient, he may certainly say both sentences, and the way it is put in the Bible, that we have actually two ways to read it. I think it's not a contradiction in the text. I think it is a contradiction in the reality. On the one hand, there is hope. On the other hand, there is a lack of hope. That is a very unique way to read this psukim. I would like to take you now for a little trip to medieval Europe. And we learn from first in the not medieval Europe, in the 19th century, exactly the same time when Leck defined the definition of euthanasia, we have an extremely interesting commentator in Germany called Rabbi Yaakov Zvi Mecklenburg, and he explains the pasuk in Sefer in Bereshit, the first book of the Bible. You are not allowed to kill, for your lifeblood I will surely exact punishment. From every living creature I will exact punishment. And the way to translate it here better would might be Miyad Ha'adam, Miyad Ish Achiv Edrosh Et Nefesh Ha'adam. For each person I will exact punishment for the life of the individual, since the man was his relatives. It says literally, even from a person killing his brother. And you could read this pasuk without that, and it would make sense. Miyad ha'adam edrosh et nefesh ha'adam. From each person I will exact punishment. Of Mecklenburg, exactly in the time when it was discussed to perform active euthanasia, he wants to see in these three words, even from a person and his brother, I will exact punishment. And he says sometimes a person kills out of mercy because he feels his brother suffers. Not he wants to kill him because he wants to punish him, to damage him. He wants to kill him out of a feeling of mercy. Even in that situation, active killing is always considered murder. It's an interesting way of interpretation. Even if it is done out of love for you fellow men. The interesting source from the 12th century is summarized here, from the same pasuk. You're not allowed to kill, and even if you kill, God will ask for punishment. The Tosafot from the 12th-13th century says, there was a story in the medieval age just during the times of the Crusades. Maaseh barav echad, Sheshachat harbet tinokot bishat hashmat. A rabbi, during the time of persecutions, he killed many little children because he was concerned that they will not survive the forced conversion to Christianity. Vayav rav echad imo vaya koes alav biyotel. There was another rabbi who was very upset. Why do you kill children? Whatever will happen to them, let them alive. Don't touch them. Don't kill them. The meaning, the intention of killing them was to save them from a worse situation. There was a real argument between them, but he didn't care. And he killed him. And at the end, he killed the children and he was killed. And the other rabbi told him, you were punished for that because later on, the persecutions were not that bad and they would have survived. There are interesting responsa taking this story, a historical situation from martyrism, which are applied, and you should never say stop. Only if it is really a terminal situation, you are allowed, as it happened in Krakow in 42, where a lot of people killed themselves. But as long as the danger is not really in front of you, you are not allowed to induce actively something, only when it is in the very last moment. I want to discuss about this source. The Talmud, and we come to the next period, says in the Mishnah very clearly, "Ein me'atzmim et hamet b'shabbat, velo b'chol im netziat hanefesh." We may not close the eyes of the dead on the Shabbat. Once he died on Shabbat, you're not allowed to touch the dead body, midin mukze, the rules for Shabbat. But on a weekday, you're not allowed to touch him at the moment of the death. As long as he is alive, not for problem of Shabbat laws, but problem of euthanasia, you should not touch the death You should not touch the dying patient to close his eyes, because that would be like to induce his death. You shouldn't do that. And the Mishnah states, whoever closes the eyes of a dying person at the moment of death is a murderer. That's very sharp. In a later source, parallel source, Masechet Smachot, it says very clearly, as long as a patient is alive, Hagoses, even if he is in his agony, he is kechai lechol davar, and you shouldn't induce anything to shorten his life. At sha'ar shayamut, till he dies. And that is repeated three times, till he dies. At sha'ar shayamut. There are more details about that, we cannot read them. But at the very end, this sentence from the Mishnah is a paraphrase, that it's compared, Rabbi Meir says, it is compared to a nail, a candle, which at the very, very end, if you just touch the candle a little bit, you're echolim l'chabot, extinguishing it. So you should be very careful not to touch this candle, because every little action could kill him. That is his paraphrase. Kach kol ha-ma'atzemet einei ha-goses ma'alim alav ke'ilu hu shomet et nishmato. And everybody who touches him is compared ke'ilu, it's like. But interesting, the Mishnah says it is exactly killing, but here it's only like. Is that a hint that it's not really killing, it's only like? The statement here is very clear, as long as he is alive, you shouldn't do anything. But to make it easier to him might be a possibility by interpreting it this way. Now I would like to take you to Jerusalem for a little trip. I take you to the Knesset. And next to the Knesset we have this wonderful piece of art, the Menorah, a present from the English government, Great Britain, to the young state of Israel. And if you look at this place here, you will see that enlarged. And you will see it even bigger. We see here a dying person. And that is a story about a famous Talmid Chacham called Rabbi Hananiah ben Tradion. And I would like to tell you the story in the Talmud. That is a masterpiece of interpretation, particularly through Rav Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, who explains this story about persecution by the Romans. And he learns many, many interesting laws of euthanasia from this interesting story. Again, a totally different context. It's not a sick person. It is a person who is going to be killed in the times of persecution by the Romans. They encountered Rabbi Hananiah ben Tradion, who was sitting engaged in Torah study and gathering in public, and a Torah scroll was resting in his lap. They therefore brought him and wrapped him in a Torah scroll, encircled him with bundles of wine shoots, and set them on fire. The purpose was to kill him. So why does this wine shoot and set them on fire? Then the Roman brought tufted wool, soaked them in water, and placed them over his heart, so that his soul would not depart quickly. They wanted to have really a long agony of this Talmid Chacham. He should suffer. He shouldn't be killed in a moment. There were a lot of techniques that they could kill their enemies in very shortly. But what they wanted to do is that he should suffer for a long time. His daughter said to him, "Father, must I see you in such a state? Abba, ereicha bekach." The person was suffering, and the daughter sees it. And here I think it's important to have a good psychological insight. What did she say by saying, "Abba, ereicha bekach"? There's no statement. What does she wish to do? She doesn't say anything. She gives a clear expression to her deep, deep pain to see a person, her father, dying in such a terrible way, so much suffer. Abba erecha b'chach. The result was there was a discussion. There was an interaction. I'm not sure if that happened historically. Nobody has a documentation that it happened. But this Talmudic legend describes how a person dies and what is in his mind, or how do the Talmudic sages describe the process of dying. Reminds me very much the process of dying described by modern psychologist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and others. He answered her, "If I alone were being burned, it would be a difficult thing for me, but there is a meaning to my death. However, now that I am being burned and the Torah scroll is with me, he who will seek retribution for this insult of the Torah scroll he will seek for my insult as well. So he is strong. He's going to suffer. And he actually tries to convince his daughter, I'm going to suffer. Rabbi Hanina's disciple said to him, Talmidim, Master, Rabbi, what do you see? He answered them, the blank parchment is burning and the letters are taking flight. That is what you see here. The parchment is burning and the letters are taking flight. You see the fire here and he suffers. So they ask him, you too, open your mouth and the fire will enter you. That is euthanasia. Do something and you shouldn't suffer. Open your mouth, take a deep breath of monoxide, and it will shorten your death. They didn't know what is the mechanism of dying, but seeing the smoke and the fire and the heat, just take a deep breath and you are done. Make it short. And now he starts with his Lamdanut, Talmudic sage. He has discussion. Rabbi Hanina said to them, no way. It's better that he who gave the soul should take it and that the person not inflict harm on himself, for sure not on somebody else. Then the Roman executioner said to him, the expression is in Hebrew, calcenturni is an expression in Latin which describes the murder of the hanger. And he makes a deal with him. The Roman executioner said to him, Master, if I increase the flame and remove the tufts of wool from you, from over your heart, will you bring me to the life of the world to come? He wants to go for a deal. During killing him, he actually wants to get out from there with a chelek la'olam haba. He also wants to have chelek la'olam haba by making his death easier. A very interesting situation. The person is going to kill him, wants to have to do it properly and to be a righteous. So Rabbi Hanina said yes. He answered him, yes, that's a fine. You can take away this the tufts of wool and you can increase the flame. I have no problem with that. I have no problem with euthanasia done in the way you want to do it, but I will not open my mouth. So he did it. Yes, the Roman guy told him, swear to me. He wanted to have the lawyer with him. He swore him to him. Immediately he increased the flame and removed the tufts of wool from over his heart, and his soul departed quickly. Then also the executioner jumped and fell into the fire. A heavenly voice issued forth and proclaimed, Rabbi Hanina ben Trabion and the executioner have now been redeemed for the life of the world to come. Both Rabbi Hanina and this Roman executioner, they are in the world to come. Rabbi cried and said, there is a person who acquires his world in a single moment, like this Roman guy, and there is another who acquires his world through several years. What do we learn from this story? And here we have an outstanding analytical approach by Rav Waldenberg. What was wrong? What is wrong that he should open his mouth and take a deep breath? He didn't agree. Why is it okay that Rabbi Hanina ben Trabion, he asked this Roman executioner, please take away the wool and increase the fire, that's fine. It might be that this story, sorry for the summary in Hebrew, you can't really learn from this story, legend of people who were dying in martyrism, Roman persecutions. You cannot learn all the halachot from there. But it gives you very, very interesting insights. Opening his mouth is actively, from his part, to do something which would induce the action of inducing death. Actively to terminate death. And he would never agree to that. Al yachbol b'adam b'atzmo. We are not allowed to do anything, not the patient and nobody else, to actively induce and to terminate death. But it is totally different if the Roman executioner comes and says, I will increase the flames and I will take away the wood from your heart. Why? Because he is going to kill him anyway. He will not leave this place until his job is done to the very end. He has to kill him. Since the underlying course and the natural course of his situation is death, increasing the fire isn't an action which is concerned to going to kill him, because he is going to do it anyway. Let the fire or the underlying disease do what is going to happen. you're not doing more fire and more death, because the situation is he will die for sure. He is terminally ill. He will not survive. He is momentarily suffering, and he will not get out of here without suffering and with his life. Once the situation is only dying, only suffering, there is no point that you shouldn't leave him, let him die. And that's a very, very interesting distinction in this story. The same is to remove the will from his heart is not causing him death. It is just to take away what prevents him to die, called in the halacha hasarat hamonea. So if he is artificially alive, meaning that he is actually a dead body, but I keep him alive, there is no mitzvah to do so. This approach is supported by a very interesting medieval scholar, Talmid Chacham, Rabbi Yehuda Hasid, in the 12th, 13th century. And he takes the pasuk, I apologize, I had no time to translate it. It says there are eight laledet, the eight lamut, time to give birth and time to die. And he says, what does it mean there is a time to die in the Bible? Yes, there is a time to die. It says, and that's the way he decides in the 13th century, early 13th century, when a person is just about to die, don't make any noise. Don't shoot to him and tell him, well, come back, try to be alive. Why? Let the soul depart. Let him go. Ein tzuakim alav bishat yetziat haneshama, kedei shelo tachzor haneshama v'yisbol yisurim kashim. Why are you doing that? Should he suffer for more time? Do you try to artificially to keep him alive and to prolong his suffering? No. Eight lamut. There is a situation when he's allowed to die. But in the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't say eight lamut. And I was wondering, what is the reason for that? I asked Rav Chaim David Halevi, Zichrono Livracha, Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv, passed away 10 years ago, and I suggested him that the Shulchan Aruch doesn't want to give an explanation. It's not a motto that you say, die, go die, it's the end. The Shulchan Aruch says it's not forbidden to do, but there is no pasuk supporting it from the Bible is a motto, go and die, because the Shulchan Aruch, in a practical context, didn't want to open any situation that you really support dying. That would be a situation which you would not like. But if it happens, you let him go, but the Shulchan Aruch doesn't quote it as an ideal situation. We come to the translation of this Rabbi Moshe, Rabbi Yehuda Hasid, in the Shulchan Aruch. And that's a fascinating source, which has many, many implications, explained by Louis Newman, Wood Choppers and Respirators in English, and many, many interesting sources by rabbis in Hebrew. Asur ligrom lemet sheyamut me'aran, that is the same flow of thoughts. It is forbidden to induce a dying person that he should die faster, quickly. Mishu goses zman aroch velo yachol liparet, if a person is in his agony for a long time and he cannot die, that's a contradiction, because goses is defined as a day, 3 days. So if somebody is goses zman aroch, it's not for a long time that he is defined as a goses. If it is for a long time, he's not goses. But there might be a situation that it is assessed, even though goses is a very short time, you extend it. Asul hashmit hakar v'hakesed, you're not allowed to pull away his pillows underneath him. Why? Because might be these pillows have something inside which keep him alive. They are sticking out there. There are feathers, and therefore he's still alive. You're not allowed to put anything under his head, like keys of the synagogue. There was an understanding. There's no way to explain it physiologically, and that's not my point to explain it physiologically. I would like to understand the idea and what their belief system was. To put keys of the synagogue which open the gates of heaven, you should not put these keys for the synagogue under his head. That might induce, according to their understanding, death. Don't do anything to induce death. Aval im yesh sham davar shegorem ikuv yetziat hanefesh, if there is a situation that he cannot die, something prevents him from dying, and he actually is ready to die, but somebody prevents it, kagon sheyesh samuch l'oto bayit kol dofek, there's a person who is chopping wood, and that keeps him artificially alive, you are allowed to tell him, stop your action and let him go. The Ein Baze Maaseh Klal, there is nothing actively involved by stopping doing something. You just tell him, take away what prevents him from dying. To apply that clinically is extremely difficult, but I think that the ventilation might be a situation to remove it, is no action by removing it. Even though, and that is the last slide of the sources, there is a fascinating Tzitzeliezer Rav Waldenberg, who has an interesting halachical approach, and at the very beginning I was smiling about this approach. Strange technicalities, but the more I think about it, I think it's a very interesting attitude. He says if a person is admitted and has to be intubated and needs ventilation, but you actually don't know what's the reason for it, he suggests use a timer for the electrical connection of the ventilation. Why? Once you have a timer like a Shaon Shabbat, that after 6 hours or 24 hours it turns off, you are not doing anything by stopping it. And if you want to continue your workup, you go for another day. If you need another week for observation, every day you reassess it and you open and you extend the timer and he is ventilated. Once you decide that there is no point, he has a brain tumor, he has brain metastasis, he has brain death, or he is severely brain damaged, and at that stage there is no obligation to prolong his life. But now you are in a catch-22. You start a ventilation. In reality, you can stop the monitoring of his ventilation, pH and arterial blood gases, and he will eventually die if you don't continue to monitor it on a practical level. But from what Rabbi Waldenberg is saying here is not a practical approach. He says the concept is that a person needs ventilation, you don't know if he is terminally ill. Might be he is, might be he has chances. You have the obligation to heal him if you feel you can heal him. But once you feel, you realize that actually his situation is terminally ill, you have no obligation to heal anymore because it's only prolonging his suffering, but you cannot turn it off. And I remember having seen physicians in Switzerland in intensive care came in the morning and told the nurse, you can pull the plug. I don't think that's a good approach. We spoke about it at the beginning, the slippery slope to pull. He didn't want to pull it. He always asked the nurse. And I think many philosophers and lawyers, they will not come and pull a plug. The approach of this Shaon Shabbat, this is very technical, and it's not coming to resolve a problem of Shabbat. It's I think it gives a very clear understanding. You try for another 24 hours and you try. But when it comes to stop, you're not going to stop actively because that's not the mission. What we should do, Eit Lamut, is not we decide about that. I think it's a very, very remarkable approach. To summarize it, I don't call it a summary because the questions are open. What I wanted to show is that the question is a very important one. We have sources to discuss that. I'd like that you have to put together all the pieces in your mind as reflected in this clip art. I think that to start mechanical ventilation for a terminally ill patient, if he is terminally ill and you know he is terminally ill, there is no obligation to prolong suffering. But if he's not terminally ill, there might be as long as you can. To remove it, we discussed that, it's of course connected to the definition of death. There might be a situation of do not resuscitate when you really feel it is a terminally ill patient. You have no obligation, it's even forbidden, to prolong suffering. Eit Lamut. There is a major, major difference between active versus passive euthanasia. Passive euthanasia, when really defined as a situation where he's terminally ill, not a situation that he will once die, all of us will once die, there's no need to say bli nedar for that. I know that people used to be very firm and to say when I will die bli nedar, it's really no need to say that. Bli nedar. But the active, to do anything actively, is a totally different notion, and I think bringing these notions together with euthanasia is actually a very misleading. The treatment of a terminally ill patient, to relieve his pain, yes, to give a mita yafa, but many other things, psychologically, bringing people together, support of the family, abba, ereicha b'chach, to listen to the daughter, to listen to the family members is absolutely important. But not to do anything actively. I'm not interested to give more answers. I could summarize Tshuvot, I think it has to be summarized with question marks. I would like to invite now Dr. Mark Greenberg. It's for me a special pleasure to introduce you, Dr. Greenberg. He has a hospital for sick children, founding member and president of POGO. It was a very, very special experience for me to actually come to Toronto to hematology oncology in 1990. I had an experience to work with you for 1 month when I decided that oncology is my field and I could fulfill here my dreams to work with you for 3 years, which was a special pleasure. And I would like to use this opportunity to thank you for many, many help you give, email, answering on different difficult patients, how to treat and when to stop treatment. And here one of your last emails you wrote a few months ago when I presented the talk we gave together actually here on medical ethics. It was a real pleasure and we'll be happy to hear now the medical context of a clinician. Please.
It's a special privilege to learn from a former student of mine who's moved leagues beyond me in the context of this kind of problem. I don't have the erudition that Benny has. I have, I guess, coming up on 35 years, I guess, of hands-on clinical experience, and I think it is that perspective that Benny asked me to talk to. I always had trouble with the concept of defining euthanasia. I think definitions may confuse us and may obscure the central role as I see it, and that is the role of the physician in the process of death and the experience of suffering. And when I try to dissect those things apart for definitional purposes, I get lost. My background: I'm a pediatric oncologist. And I'm a pediatric oncologist who began a career in the early 1970s. And so I have dealt day in, day out with death and suffering. And I've watched a transformation in the world of oncology such that we now have 80% survival rates. But when I started, that survival rate was 10%. And so I've had a lot to do with dying children, much less to do with dying adults. And there are some fundamental differences. Benny talked about the principles of ethics. When one talks about adults, the focus, and I guess the focus really has changed since the mid-60s, the focus is on autonomy. And clearly that focus on autonomy deals with the fact that an adult has beliefs, precepts, values, experience, and therefore has a capacity to make, or a basis on which to make decisions, and above all, has the rational capacity to make decisions. And even if that individual does not have the rational capacity to make decisions, the substitute decision makers have a track record with which to work. We know who this person was. We know the values by which they lived. We know the precepts that drove their lives. In a child, we are dealing with a totally different context. And the principle that drives the ethical decision-making here is not autonomy. The application of autonomy to childhood is wrong. This is about beneficence. The driving force in the ethical decision-making around child decision-making must be beneficence. And inevitably, there are substitute decision makers. And I guess I would say to you, I can think of no more emotional enfolding, entwining context than the context of a dying child. And because there is such intense and deep emotion, the application of rationality becomes a much more difficult issue. A child has no track record. The child has no values unless they are the values imputed to the child by the substitute decision makers. The substitute decision makers are faced with this extraordinary conflict between self-interest and the child's best interests. What do I mean by that? I mean that, again, there can be no more difficult context than to have to make a decision about the life or death of your child and try not to view that through the eyes of the impact on yourself. It's an extraordinary circumstance. Set also in the context that in the process of a child's development, the child is going through a developmental trajectory, beginning with no viable cognitive function and not much emotional function, through on to adolescence and competence. But at the same time, the family is going through a developmental trajectory, each parent on their own, and both parents as a pair are also evolving a developmental trajectory. In that context, what then is the role of the physician? And I don't know that I know the answers. I think Benny has framed eloquently many of the questions. What are the issues? Forging an alliance with the family, working as a unit, as a team, on the same team. But primarily, beneficence to the child and acting in the child's best interests. That, for me, has always been an enormous personal value conflict. Because when I look at a dying child in pain and suffering, one set of my values say, do not allow this child to suffer. And another set of my values say, and who are you to intervene in any active or aggressive fashion? We are all taught in our medical school days the concept of futility. When life becomes futile, there is no purpose. The definition of futility, however, is a very difficult one. Does futility mean the absence of utility? It is not a useful life to live. Or does futility mean being present is purposeless? And it is an ongoing conflict that I have faced innumerable times. And so, the question I face in these contexts is, what is beneficence? Under these circumstances, what is beneficence, and how do you determine best interests? Who decides and who gives authority? I don't know, but what I can distill from my years, and I hope some of the issues that Benny has framed, I believe that the prolongation of suffering as an active intervention is not morally defensible. And that is your issue of beginning ventilation in a child or a person for whom the act will be a prolongation of suffering. It's what Benny talked about keeping artificially alive. Maybe it's about your wood chopper. Maybe it's about the feathers or the keys to the synagogue. But I do believe that the prolongation of suffering as an active intervention is not acceptable. The provision of comfort is always a priority. Any measure that is designed specifically to provide comfort, even if it impacts on the duration of life, is, in my view, acceptable. I believe that is my beneficence. By contrast, any measure specifically designed to alter duration of life as its primary intent, even if a byproduct is the relief of comfort, is not acceptable. I cannot do that, and I don't believe that we should. Who grants me the authority to make those decisions? And that's where it becomes much more complicated. I think who grants me that authority is the physician's code of ethics, the principle of beneficence, my obligation as a healer, which I believe to be my avocation, and my faith. And hopefully, the other part of that permission is granted by the family, the primary caregivers of the patient, the ones who can and will have to transcend their own needs and perceive the best interests of the person we are all focused on at the time. And at the end, I and each of us am responsible to myself, to my patient, to my faith. I don't know that I can answer any of the questions Benny's put forward, other than to draw on those years of clinical experience and the readings around them. Thank you for the privilege of following Benny.
We'll take a couple questions. It's just while you think of the questions, just while I was listening to the presentations, I was thinking of where in the Parshiot, in between the books, Operation and Shmot. And we read last week by Yechi Yaakov, Yaakov lived to be 147, and we know that if you look in the Chumash, he's the only one up to that point who was sick. Everybody else, they actually die. And our sages, of course, with the keen insight, explain that until the time of Yaakov, nobody actually was sick. They sneezed and they died. And Yaakov actually begged HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he doesn't want to die all of a sudden. He wants to have a prolonged death, if I can use, you know, such a term, to be able to speak to his children, to put his life in order. And it's really a blessing, a privilege from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we often do have a deathbed and it takes time. But of course, with every blessing comes its difficulties, and it's not all simple. And I just think this is the issue that we are struggling with. The blessing of prolonging life, but when the prolonging of life becomes the elongation of death, as Benny said, that's when we have our moral issues. So I just, like everybody has said, I clearly don't have any of the answers, but we will take, you know, Benny and Dr. Greenberg will take, I guess, even from a halakhic point of view, or, you know, questions that may affect in terms of cases, what to do, and we'll try to give a few types of guidelines that Dr. Greenberg can ask from a clinical point of view. So I'll step aside, and Dr. Jessen can ask the first question.
I think the situation of which we have here in Abu Dazara, the story, is a very, very meaningful one. At the end, he jumped in the fire. Why? Abu Chanina ben Tzadon, he swore him. Everything is fine. You have Olam Haba. Why do you jump in the fire? It's very interesting to understand this Talmudic passage in a psychological way. He was allowed to do it, to increase the fire and to remove the wool. But personally, he couldn't cope with that. So I think the treating person, you have also to take care of his autonomy. Where is he in this situation? He is allowed to do it. He wasn't a big tzaddik in the whole context, but even though he was allowed to do that, he couldn't live with that afterwards. So I think that gives a very interesting insight. I think it reminds very much, as you said before, to stop the ventilator. If it is exactly the same or not, there might be lamdanut, halachical discussions allows us that really compare it to that, but might be you cannot compare it, because if the whole context of the situation is different. If the ventilation after day two, and there are never say never in medicine, after a few days he's improving and nobody believes it and everybody says it's a miracle, it happens. In the context of Avodah Zarah persecutions, he is going to be killed. He will not get out of there. The Kalsenturi, this hanger, he will not leave, this executioner, he will not leave the place before he is a dead body. So really, to apply it halachically, I'm not sure if you can really learn it. The reason I wanted to show it is that the analysis helps to understand principles and how the conflicting interests, how they come together. Regarding your second question of DNR, when I was a medical student in my third year in Switzerland, I had a rotation in emergency room, and people came in at the age of 80, 85, and they have a DNR order. And I couldn't understand why. I could not understand why. They are not totally healthy, but they are not in a terminally ill situation. And I asked them, what's the definition? and nobody could tell me. I don't know what the rules are in Canada. In Israel, I ask, is he DNR? Yes, he is. Why don't you sign it? Why don't you discuss it with the family? Because we don't sign. So who does really define it? According to the definitions I would like to suggest from our sources which I've presented you before, if there's a situation shahaneshama lo yachola liparet, that he's going to die, but somebody prevents it, prevents the last step to die, the process of dying is just started, you are not supposed to stop that. In this situation, there is a situation where it would say, Eit lamut, do not resuscitate. That's the only context where I would accept, halachically, from my understanding and personally, that there is no obligation to continue. The guy in Switzerland told me, you know, at the age of 80, I don't see a reason. You can be a person, could be DNR at the age of 3 years, and he could be in a good shape at the age of 85. If you can keep treatment. So the principles given there don't make sense to me at all. The only way I would like to translate DNR is that he is actually going to die. I should not prevent it. And there is a mitzvah not to cause him suffering and a prolongation of his terrible situation of dying without any hope. That's a mitzvah of do not resuscitate. I would sign that Eit Lamut, the way Rav Yehuda Hasid does it. Any other situation, and I saw very often patients where it says DNR or certain age should decide about DNR is not acceptable. I agree with you, in a nursing home, there are additional questions. If a person is mentally reduced, is a severe Alzheimer, is there still the obligation? It comes to very difficult situations. It's very difficult for me. I don't like to give a clear yes or no. I don't think that there is an ongoing mitzvah if the underlying situation is so painful that you have to keep everything for each price alive. But I keep in mind the slippery slope, and probably I would say wait for how he responds to treatment. I just remember 2 weeks ago a person was asked me, and the rabbi, he asked the rabbi, and the rabbi wanted to discuss it with me. A very sick person with after many strokes, and they wanted to stop treatment. And I think that there's basic things which we're not allowed to stop, like oxygen and fluids. Intravenous fluids might be antibiotics. Ventilation is a more aggressive, invasive treatment, which for this situation might not be appropriate. And they agreed with that. They stopped and they did not go to the hospital emergency room for ventilation, and she improved spontaneously with oxygen and fluids. And Lasix. So I think that it's important to keep in mind that DNR doesn't mean stop everything. You have to make a gradual different distinction between very aggressive, heroic procedures and others. Dr. Greenberg mentioned before about the child, the emotional world of seeing a child dying. It says in the Torah in Bereshit. To see a child dying is emotionally extremely difficult. To see a very old person after a long life and a happy life going holech b'derech kol ha'aretz is emotionally a major difference. I'm not aware that the halacha makes a distinction between the quality of a worthy, young, meaningful life and an old person. It's a tragedy in any situation, once it is natural and once it is not natural. I'm not aware of a distinction like that. But I am aware, and I have actually had a slide, well, one of the slides I skipped is a prayer for a dying patient. And it's very interesting. There is a prayer. The Talmud tells two stories when Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was dying, he was very, very sick. And it all, everybody was praying for him that he should survive. And his a person who worked with him, she couldn't see him suffer. So she made something, Gemara Masechet Ketuvot Kuf Dalet, she made something, she threw something from the window, and everybody was looking there what fell there, and they stopped praying for a few moments, and he died, and he could separate. That's it on the level of Tefillah. How would I apply that for a practical context? I wouldn't. Because the world of prayer, even though there are some very interesting papers in New England Journal, that praying is very meaningful and could prolong his well-being of the patient. I'm not going to mix the world of prayer, which I'm very interested in, to the way of the treatment. One is the approach, the attitude, or, as you mentioned it before, the emotional world. I wish for this child, for this patient, let him go. But even though in the halacha in the late 50s, there was a Poseik of Herzog who explained that people who are treating him, they are not allowed to pray. Because their emotional world is keep treating if there is a point to treat. A person who wants to pray, that's on another different level. Therefore, I think as long as there is medically indicated, this he has a chance to survive. He is not dying now. There is no active process of dying. You have to keep treating. Treatment. If in geriatrics there are exceptions like mentally damaged, strokes, and Alzheimer, I'm not aware of distinction like that. I would think that people would agree to poskim, but they will not write it because they're concerned about slippery slope. Yeah, it's interesting that Rabbi Kelman explained the Parashat HaShavua, the two nurses in the parasha are called Shifra and Pua. Shifra is also expression for a tube. So they, one of the commentators say that they really intubated these babies as part of a treatment. I think it's not the term resuscitation or Hachya. We are not bringing back life. If he is dead, he is dead. If we can treat him, we are treating him. I asked several times rabbis that they should give a clear-cut answer, and the summary was that I had no clear answer. If the physician feels, a different physician feels, that there is really no medical indication to keep treating because there will be no improvement, meaning if a person needs ventilation will need it forever, an oncology patient or cardiac insufficiency, and you don't see that he will improve because he's not responding to all the other treatments, you have no obligation to do that. I think at that moment the idea of Waldenberg with the timer, you can try doing that, and if after 3 days you see there's really nothing moving, nothing is going on, it's psychologically a good approach. You tried, they will not blame you that you didn't try everything. If you don't see that any improvement, you're entering a gray zone. You give a trial and you step back afterwards. It's very difficult to answer on general rules. Please.
Oncology is kind of a new thing for me, but my perception is when they call in the oncologist, they more or less have given up on the patient recovering in terms of healing from whatever condition he's in, and they're more or less just managing his life from that point on. Obviously you have to be a doctor to be an oncologist, but wouldn't you consider it to be, once they've called in the oncologist, really the regular doctor doesn't have anything more to do with this decision-making process?
Only who has to decide? The oncologist.
Well, I'm just saying, it seems to be, you're talking about this in terms of being a doctor, but really they're calling you in as an oncologist. And somebody has made a decision, more or less, that this person will not be healed from whatever the problem is.
That's true. But even if he won't be healed, I think there's an important step in the life of this patient. How is he going to die? And if that is the idea of V'hafta l'arecha kamocha b'ro lo mita yafa, there's still a lot to do with a dying patient. It might be a week, might be many months of palliative care. And I think even if a person decides there is no hope and this patient is lost from an approach to cure him, there is a lot of obligation to help him how he will die. Pain treatment, psychology, and a lot of support.
But would you call that really being a doctor? Wouldn't that be more like a psychiatrist or a counselor as opposed to being a doctor? I think you have to split what's happening here. And a doctor really is concerned with healing a person. If you made the decision the person can't be healed, it's a different profession.
Yes, I think that there's a field, a specialty of palliative care, and it's not the purpose is not to heal. The purpose is to make to organize these last part of the life meaningful, respectful. It's not the same mission as healing. And many doctors, they like to fix and to send him home and he is great and happy. That's not the situation here. But there's certainly an importance of rapport et rapport, that he should be a relief and have the possibility to die peacefully. So I agree with you that there needs a lot of psychology and psychiatrists and other support. But I think there's still a medical function of pain relief and many things around that. Right. I would like to ask first the first question regarding the two teams. This concept of having two teams treating and you shouldn't mix and work together, we know that in transplantation surgery, if a person is on a respirator and he's actually proclaimed as being brain dead and the family is approached for organ donation, because in surgery department they need kidneys and whatever they want to transplant, this team from surgery is not allowed, according to the Swiss and German law, to approach the family because they have an interest. They need a kidney. The family has to be approached only by intensive care or wherever that this patient is admitted in order to define death. And afterwards, another team will come in once this decision is made to approach this patient for organ donation. This concept reminded me very much what I found in the Tshuva by Rav Herzog, that the family, and not everybody agrees with that, you're allowed to pray, and actually we have prayers, text of prayers, which you would say for this dying patient. Elohim, you should do the way in the best interest of this patient. Whatever you feel is the best for him, do it. Even in the prayer, we do not pray, let him die. We just say, L'tovato v'le ulenafsho. I don't remember, and that's from the late 1700s. Professor Steinberg brings it up in his encyclopedia. So it's a very interesting concept of praying and even not speaking out what you really want. Therefore, I think that all the discussions about that are much later, and if a person feels, let him die. The daughter of Rabbi Chananya ben Trodion, she said, Abba erecha b'chach, and she was probably praying. There are no clear halachot about that. It's not brought in the Shulchan Aruch, and I think we should decide not to decide about that. Everybody should do it the way he feels it's most appropriate. I couldn't find clear halachot about that, and I was very happy I couldn't find it. That's your first question. Remind me the second question?
No touching,
yes. And here I remember very often having seen patients, Orthodox patients, coming to intensive care and being concerned how to hold the tube. I personally am convinced that they're doing the wrong thing, but it doesn't help me anything because I'm not there as a rabbi. I'm not trying to be there as a rabbi. I have to take care of other parts of the treatment. I don't think that the source wants to say that kol hanogea bo, it's like a candle and you shouldn't touch him. If to touch and to hold his hand might be the last way of communication with a person, sedated, affected neurologically, asleep, the only way that you can really still a little bit interact would be by touching him. So if touching him has not the purpose to finish his life, to terminate the life, that's not called terminating his life. That's treating him, being in touch with him, and being in touch with him physically. To touch him is part of the treatment. I mentioned that to several rabbis, including Rav Chaim David Halevi, and he fully agreed. And I think that this concern of leaving the very sick patient on his own and not touching him, just the nurse is allowed to clean and to suction of the tube, and she's allowed to do everything, technically. I think that is really actually to add more suffering to the patient who really needs the warmth and the connection. And I don't think that is what the source talks about, that you're not allowed to touch. It's like a candle. A candle, you have to protect it. The only context where it is forbidden to touch, and the purpose is to close his eyes and let him go.
to actively induce dying. So if you remember the first slide, that euthanasia is to act an action of inducing death, that is what Chazal wanted to say. You're not allowed to do that, but if touching him means actually that you show interaction with him, I think it is not only allowed, it is actually an obligation to be in touch with him.